Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The government's Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee just made headlines this month by releasing new guidelines that more or less upended the way we structure our diets. Among the recommendations, issued every 5 years, coffee? Not so bad anymore. Cholesterol? No longer the devil. And we should pay more attention to the planet when it comes to our eating habits, namely that a plant-focused diet low on red meat is actually environmentally sustainable. Now, food, please meet climate change. That's a great example of food policy issue. And here to elaborate on this and other food policy issues is the Culinary Institute of America's Daryl Mosher. In his courses, he covers everything from herbs and nuts to quality control and the purchasing cycle. He's also an expert on sustainable agriculture and will be launching a new sustainable food systems program at CIA that looks at the natural resources used in the production of food. And on top of all that, he's an active farmer and president of Brittany Hollow Farm in Red Hook. So let's talk about food policy, sustainability, and all related topics today. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org, tweet us at WAMC Radio with the hashtag VoxPop, or you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. It's a long introduction. Daryl Mosher, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray.
So nice to have you here. Once again, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. So you are launching a new sustainable food systems program at Culinary Institute. Let's start and talk about that.
Okay. It's actually an applied food studies program.
Okay.
And I will be teaching a course I developed on sustainable food systems.
What will you teach? What have you learned?
Yeah, well, my interest, and again, my background, family farm for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
As my kids got older and they got involved in education, I went back in and got an additional education. I work with Green Mountain College in Vermont and have taken their master's courses in their sustainable food system program. My personal interest, though, I kind of view myself as an environmentalist. I've always been interested in nature. I understand the cost of producing food, the necessary cost, and I'm going to focus on the inputs. Principally, we're going to look at things like water, soil, energy, and support of our food production. And then there's some negatives. We have to look at what they call externalities. There are some bad things associated. I mean, a simple example would be the nitrogen that might run out of the ground and get into the local waters and move into a sound or whatever and cause an algal bloom, which would longer term lead to a eutrophication and essentially a dead zone in our. And that occurs in Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf. So
sure.
A number of those issues.
There were a number of guidelines released. The guidelines were released this month. And the panel's findings, this is the agriculture, let me make sure I get it right here. This is the Agriculture Committee, yes?
Well, the report goes to Health and Human Services and the Secretary of Agriculture.
It's the nation's top nutritional panel, basically.
That's right. And it's what it was. It's an advisory group. It's made up of experts from around the country. And on a five-year basis, they basically update our nutrition or dietary guidelines.
And so the usual things about, you know, avoid too much salt, sugar, things like saturated fats, but there's a political angle now, and it's a political football. The panel's findings, and I'll quote from the Washington Post, issued Thursday in the form of a 571-page report, recommended that Americans be kinder to the environment by eating more foods derived from plants and fewer foods that come from animals. Red meat is deemed particularly harmful because of, among other things, the amount of land and feed required in its production. Now, members of Congress... Some members of Congress say, hey, you know what, stick to what you know, stick to nutrition, leave these other issues out. But you don't agree.
Well, I mean, I agree they should follow their charter, but I think it's important, and we may not be ready for it, but it is time to recognize that our food choices and our agricultural system does have consequences in terms of, in the case, again, natural resources. Just because they put it in there doesn't mean it will be adopted.
Mm.
But I think it is interesting. I mean, an extreme way of looking at it is if you took the average American diet and somehow pushed that out on the rest of the world, the 7 billion people in the world, we would need to have about three times the food we produce right now. So clearly, I think that's a pretty eye-opening example of the potential impacts associated with our production of food.
It's a fascinating topic. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Daryl Mosier is our guest. Let's go to the phones. Andrew in Cohoes, you're first. Andrew.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Daryl. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, sure.
I wanted to thank you both for what you do. Ray, I appreciate the conversations you start, and some of them can be quite funny. And so my question is kind of two-parted. You can choose to answer whichever you like. The first is, are GMOs important, you know, GMO crops? If so, why? And then the second question is, are GMOs something that should be vilified, whether that's, you know, true or not? You know, are there any resources I can point friends and family to that can help explain why they might be, you know, necessary?
Great way to start the show, Andrew. Good going.
All right, Andrew, the first part, I think where we are in today's system, we are at a point where technology such as GMOs clearly have a role to play. I know a lot of people don't like to hear that, but I will tell you, organizations such as the World Health Organization, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, they all have endorsed it primarily for social benefit. I'll give you a quick example. Parts of northern Africa, some of the sub-Saharan areas, their diet basically is more than 50% a local tuber called a cassava. And that cassava has been blighted with a virus. If those people can't get that, their local production, that where it's going to be a major famine, which, of course, can have significant consequences. There is a GMO cassava that has the ability to be have an immunity to that virus. So there is possibly some social good. That's not to say that there are potentially other issues. I mean, some of the big issues that most people talk to are the impact of biodiversity. You know, historically, we grew a great number of different vegetables, even within a single cultivar, if you will. In the United States, in 1860, I think we had 6,000 varieties of apples. Today, we have under 600.
But a lot of those just weren't very viable, were they? I mean, some of these so-called heirloom varieties are heirlooms for a reason, as I understand it.
Well, I mean, the whole point is, yeah, we grow. People want, you know, they want texture, they want size, they want shape, they want flavor, they want ideally nutrition. So that's what we've done. Through selection, breeding selection, we've basically created things that are preferred. Not a bad thing, but the consequences, a lot of these other varietals in terms of biodiversity, they may have had genetics that will come in handy in the future relative to, again, a virus. They may be more flexible in terms of dealing with things like our climate change.
Andrew, you want to follow up?
Yeah, one follow-up. Sometimes folks will quite aggressively say that GMOs are harmful to their bodies, and I just wanted to see from your point of view, you know, any reasons why that might be true or not true.
Okay, very good. I've done a lot of reading, certainly not everything that's out there, and folks are welcome to get out. I mean, there's volumes of information on GMOs. It does not appear, as best I can tell, that there is any science that says they are harmful to health. Now, again, these are the GMOs that have been approved in this country by our FDA.
And patented?
I mean, the patent's a different issue because, and that is potentially a problem, that you buy the seed, but you don't own the seed, but you sign a contract to the effect. So the issue is what we call open source seed. Historically, seed has been a resource to be shared within a community. And with GMO, that's not the case. But from a health perspective, there really doesn't appear to be any evidence, and I know that's the first thing that comes into mind. And maybe part of it is that we haven't treated it properly. I don't have a problem with labeling. I do understand the cost, and it may increase the cost of our food. But I think the best way to deal with these things is for people to kind of get away from lecturing and have good discussion like we're having now and getting that information out. And if you're going to have GMOs in the marketplace, which, by the way, there are very few in the marketplace today in terms of fresh ingredients. When we talk about GMOs in the marketplace, these are processed foods. And as you're probably aware, Vermont took the lead. They're the only state that passed a resolution that all foods will be labeled if they have GMOs starting, I believe it's July of next year.
Yeah. Andrew, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Why now? 1-800-348-2551 is the number. So this issue of owning patents on seeds, or owning the seeds, and this is the political aspect, one of the political aspects of GMOs. And at what point does a seed be in the wild or be out there that it becomes public domain?
Well, I mean, historically, all seeds are public domain. They were a consequence of nature and natural selection. Man, for a long time, has been selectively breeding to create characteristics that they found as more valuable. In the last, certainly, half century, three-quarter century, breeders got involved and did a lot of work in labs, and they came up with varieties that were significantly better. And they put patent variety protection on those so they could recoup their investment. Even those seeds technically were not allowed to be kept other than by the farmer for personal use. Hmm. So the seeds, this issue, this open source seed has been an issue, and in a purely natural sense, it rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
We're going to take a break here. Daryl Mosier from the Culinary Institute is our guest. We talk sustainability, food policy, and all sorts of other stuff. We'll be back at 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from Sundog Cider at Solaqua, locally produced hard cider from New York Hudson Valley apples, unfiltered, naturally gluten-free, handcrafted at a revitalized solar-powered mill in Chatham, New York. SundogCider.com. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their new website with more information about membership, grants, and loans, so our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. And Schenectady Green Market, a community marketplace providing fresh local produce and artisan goods downtown every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. inside Proctor's. SchenectadyGreenMarket.org.
It's Vox Pop Food Friday on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. We talk food policy with Daryl Mosier of the Culinary Institute, and a new major being started, the Applied Food Studies.
Yeah, it's really important, and it ties really into the call we just got from Andrew. You know, the chefs of the past, clearly their goal was just to delight a customer. They needed to have the skill, the technique, know the cooking methods. Today's chef has a lot more responsibility. The food world's changing. They have an obligation to understand the bigger issues surrounding food. And in fact, a lot of the chefs, you know, will be in a position, a leadership position, with respect to their community and their food system. So, and the students really, they really have a lot of hunger for this in terms of coming in. They're all interested in farm to table. They question sourcing when they're looking at ingredients. So it's really a kind of a new wave in the culinary world.
You know, we've done a lot of these Food Fridays, and oftentimes we'll have chefs, and almost to a person, to a chef, they're big into farm to table and local sourcing. And they say, forget all the other stuff, it just tastes better.
Well, I'm a big fan of local, and I will tell you a little secret. I think local not only tastes better, I think it is better. And it's a pretty simple reason. If I'm a local grower and I have that relationship with my customer, I'm going to grow something for them that they can be discernible in terms of the value over that which is available otherwise in the market. And the reason I'm able to do it is very simple. If I'm a big grower and I'm shipping product all over the world, when I select that varietal, I'm really focused on two things. How does it ship, and how long is its shelf life?
Yeah.
If I'm a local grower, I don't worry about that at all. I worry about what does it look like, how does it taste, if I can get some information on nutritional value. Because I'm going to pick it in the morning, and somebody might be having it on their lunch. So yeah, there is a big difference.
And the economics. Just keeping it local helps a lot of people locally.
Well, there is an economic multiplier. There's lots of reasons. I've actually had opportunity to talk with hundreds, if not thousands, of people in terms of what's their personal value statement for organic? What's the personal value statement for local? And it's kind of all over the board, but they all make sense. They all kind of tie into a system. And as far as I'm concerned, whatever angle they have, providing we get the buy-in from them, it works.
1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Daryl Mosier of the Culinary Institute is our guest. Let's go to Antonia in Albany. You're on.
Hi. I was just wondering about, you know, you spoke about red meat and how that's not sustainable as, you know, as much as we eat it in America and stuff. I was just wondering if, you know, meats like poultry and fish, things like that, is that, like, more sustainable? Does it have less of an environmental impact than red meat?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And I didn't really mean to say, meat is unsustainable on a world basis based on the U.S. consumption. And I mean, it's fundamentally, it's driven by our population. If we had many less people, clearly, it wouldn't be a problem. Yeah, now, there's a lot of ways to look at it, and there's a lot of good research out there. You can look at it on a calorie basis. In other words, we eat for fuel. You can look at it on a gram basis of protein or some carbohydrate. You can look on it just a raw kilogram or pound of meat. When you look at them in terms of, let's say, water, beef is at least 10 to 15 times worse than chicken. So chicken, in terms of our consumption of water, is 15 times more efficient than beef. And you should know, on a world basis, 70% of fresh water is used in agriculture. In the United States here, it's a little less, but it is an issue. We use 40% of it, and as you're probably well aware, a lot of our big farming areas, especially the crop areas, are have some significant shortages now.
Thanks, Antonia. We appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551. Well, you'd mentioned when we were in the green room that Americans' intake of red meat is down something like 50 or 100 pounds in the last decades.
Yeah, if you look, I mean, it looks like it peaked around 305, 306 based on USDA.
Per person. 305,
on a per capita basis.
Per year.
So it sounds a lot, like a pound a day. Surprised me. It's down to about 260 now.
Okay.
So the diet has changed.
But, I mean, could this just be economics at play? It's more and more expensive to get beef.
I mean, it certainly could, and that's the point. Our food is a system. It ties to economic, it ties to natural resources, it ties to social issues. It certainly could be.
Well, my question, I guess, is, isn't it a self-regulating system to some extent? In other words, if beef becomes more and more expensive to produce and to buy, won't our intake automatically go down? Do we need guidelines that say stop it for
of
reasons?
That's, you know, that's basic economic supply and demand. That's probably true. But the market, and I am a free market guy, but the market isn't entirely free in the sense that if we look at 40% of the agriculture in this country is soybean and corn. And you think them, they're really not for human consumption. A big part of the corn, for example, more than a third of it is for to feed animals. Another third is roughly to make our ethylene that we're using in our fuel oils. And then that remaining third is just for food.
Okay. We'll go back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Robert in Middletown, you're up.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is in reference to, you had made a comment in reference to, you know, FDA regulations and so on. It seems as though we're not always being protected necessarily by the FDA. As far as the, you know, Food and Drug Administration goes, they have a certain allowance of certain things being in foods. And I'm finding that with local growers, you don't necessarily have to worry so much about that. And I'm finding that when I follow that type of local grower's diet, whether it be beets or honey or vegetables, I notice that I feel a lot better as compared to things that may be supposedly on the market out there and supposedly more regulated by the FDA, where they say, well, you know, this beef is 100% this or that. We don't know what's in it necessarily anymore. And I think that local growers and producers seem to have so many more benefits. I just wish the public was more aware of this.
Well, again, it's a good point. I do think local growers offer a better product because it's actually a different variety. I like to believe the FDA is doing their job, and I think our conventionally produced foods is safe and healthy. And one of the reasons I want to believe that is if you look at our organic food in terms of food and beverage, it's just over 5%. And that would say 95% of the food we consume, and that especially those people that can't afford organic, are at a great health disadvantage. And I don't believe that's the case. But I do believe that And I hear this from a lot of people. You feel better about local product. And that's important because I think that's the fix to our system. We got to get more food within our areas being produced. And the reason being simply you have that connection and you can shape how it's produced, what they grow. You just have a lot of input. And I think that's healthier for a community.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Here's one, Daryl, from Amy in New Paltz. This is via email. She says, I was recently diagnosed with a severe allergy to mammalian meat, beef, pork, lamb, etc., due to a tick bite from a certain species of tick. Have you heard of this, and what effect could this have on the food industry if it becomes more widespread? Many people have called in about reducing red meat intake. That's from Amy in New Paltz.
One thing I wasn't clear on, Amy, I have not heard about, and I've had some serious, as a farmer, as you can imagine, the Hudson Valley, I've had about every tick illness there is in the last 20 years. I am not familiar, unless you're talking about the animal had a tick bite and that changed the meat. I'm not sure.
No, she says she was diagnosed with a severe allergy from a tick bite.
That's news to me, Amy. I just don't know anything about that.
Okay, well, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. Ellen in Niskayuna. Ellen, you're on.
Hi. Can you tell me if the wheat plant has been genetically modified?
Okay. Certainly there are wheats that have been genetically modified. There are lots of wheat plants. In fact, I was looking at some numbers. We have a seed vault in Slovabad, Norway, where we're trying, for biodiversity purposes, we're trying to capture all the genetic variety of seeds across the world. And in that seed vault, they have 40,000 varieties of wheat. So certainly, and they are not putting GMO varieties into the vault. So clearly, there are options. But if you're not working with directly with an organic grain producer, if you're just buying processed foods at a local supermarket, all bets are off. You're not sure what you're getting.
Okay, Ellen, thanks a lot for the call. I saw a great documentary on that seed vault. Really quite something. How long will seeds last in a controlled environment?
I mean, the point is if you control them properly, we're certainly talking about thousands of years.
Yeah, and this is they're doing this in case of a mass disaster.
Yeah, they nicknamed the Doomsday Vault.
Yeah.
It's not a good thought.
No, it isn't. Let's go to Alexandra in Kingston. Alexandra, you're on. You got to turn your radio down a little bit, okay?
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know more information about this new program at the CIA and also your thoughts on getting this information out to the general public on a broader level. I have a lot of friends with little kids and they just feed them really, really terrible foods because they don't know any better, and it's like a vicious cycle. These children are growing up thinking that that's the best thing, that's the right thing to eat. So I just want to know your thoughts on that as well.
Right. Okay, well, the first thing in terms of our new program at the Culinary Institute of America, on our website, there's lots of information. And again, it's an applied food studies program. As a prerequisite, the applied part of it, it does require the two-year degree in the hands-on kitchen, so the associate's degree in the culinary skills or the baking and pastry. After that, it is a bachelor's major where we talk about certainly my class, which is sustainable food systems, but we look at policy, we look at history, we look at anthropology, and we look at ecology or the relationship, the social issues between people and food. The second part, help me again if you have the second part I can answer.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to know your thoughts on the importance of getting this information about organic food and local agriculture and sustainability out to the broader public. I think education is a huge part in this, and a lot of people eat bad food because they don't necessarily know any better.
No, absolutely, and that's why I'm really glad to be here today. This is a conversation or discussion that we need to start having. There is lots of material. There's a lot of like-minded people, dining clubs. Certainly, on the internet, you can find information. And the program, especially the one we have at the Culinary Institute of America for the new students, is going to be there'll be a lot more people that are well-versed.
Alexandra, thanks a lot for the call. It is Vox Pop. It is a Food Friday. You can, of course, tweet us at WAMC Radio, hashtag Vox Pop. Our guest today is Daryl Mosier of the Culinary Institute. We talk food policy and sustainability and whatnot. Let's go to Michelle in Windsor, Vermont. Michelle.
Hi, Daryl. My husband and I are brand new farmers, and we're just going, we've got a beautiful 96 by 30 greenhouse with a beautiful hydroponic system in it.
Beautiful.
And we're getting ready to gear up to start trying to market our product. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions as to the best way to approach chefs and, you know, people like that to
sure.
get them to buy our stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that was my model early on. I mean, I wanted to be different. I direct marketed to chefs back in, and actually I think as early as 1990 was the first year. It's really easy. The thing you have to understand, though, is you probably, this is a good time of year, maybe a little late, you should be talking to the chefs now. They all have wish lists. They have things that they can't get in terms of the quality or condition that they'd like to have in their kitchen. And so start the relationship. They feel somewhat committed once they tell you, boy, if you could plant this for me. And then, of course, yet you do have to bring them a good product.
Mm.
But there's, the chefs are, it's very easy. In fact, I've told people in the past, I don't think I ever went to a chef who didn't buy something from me.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay, and wish me luck.
Yeah, well,
thanks
good luck
lot,
to you,
Michelle.
And congratulations on the new farm.
Thanks.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551. Ron and Colony. Ron, you're up.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
First off, I think everyone ought to write down 1RadioNetwork.com, spelled out 1. There's a scientist from MIT, that's Patrick Timpone. It's the greatest radio show ever.
All right.
But anyhow,
thanks for promoting another radio show on this one.
No, this is not like yours. This is basically 75% health.
We're very low. Okay. Well, anyway, what's your point?
Well, he's had a scientist from MIT who does nothing but study genetically modified foods and glycophosphates. The information is pretty much out there, and she says it's so scary. I've heard her for about 5 hours. Just take the salmon, which I'm sure everybody is aware of. When they did the study on the salmon, they found no ill effects. But they only went out 3 months. Once you go past 3 months, that's when you start seeing unbelievable tumors. Really, really bad stuff.
Okay. All right.
And as far as the farmers in India that were, told, you got to start using these seeds, that land then becomes basically not good yet. You have to keep buying their seeds.
Is that true?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You can't go. And if it blows over into somebody who's not using those seeds, they will sue you.
All right, let's ask Derek.
I can clear that last piece up. I mean, you said a lot of different things.
Yeah,
I don't know about I will tell you this. This is a fact. In the United States, none of the big GMO companies, and Monsanto takes the rap, have sued a U.S. farmer for genetic drift. That is
I'm not sure about that.
Is a fact, and there's lots of legal databases. However,
they are suing other farmers because I've heard them.
No, they did. The big case was in Canada, not the United States.
Ah, interesting.
But they can. It's a civil suit. They do sue farmers,
mm-hmm.
but they sue them for a different reason. The farmers sign a contract to say they will not keep that seed.
They can't keep it. You can't reproduce with that seed.
Oh,
you have to.
You largely can. You're talking about the seed termination technology where you make the seed sterile.
Right.
That's very limited. The FDA is not on board with that.
Ron, I love the fact that when we do topics of all stripes, you got a different angle, and I appreciate the call very much. Ron in Colony, good job. Let's go to Evie in Kingston. Evie.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much, Mr. Moser. First of all, I want to say thank you to all the new farmers, the young people that are going into farming. But I'd like to ask Mr. Moser your views on methane production through all the animals that we produce for food. My understanding is that methane is a very important one of the greenhouse gases. And if we reduce the amount of food production, meat production, that we can have a very immediate effect on reducing the greenhouse gases. Methane is one of the least persistent of carbon dioxide takes quite a while to be reabsorbed, but methane is least persistent, and those animals are all creating enormous amount of waste.
We get it.
Yeah, that's
so your comment on that, please.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, you're right. When we talked about beef, I said in terms of the water to produce a pound of beef.
Right.
And now if you look at some of the externalities, methane production. I will say methane is a significant greenhouse gas, certainly. It is largely associated with our ruminants. So you don't typically think of it with, let's say, a pig or a chicken. Now, if their waste is not composted.
Right.
Yeah, well, it needs to be composted with air. Methane is created through an anaerobic process in the absence of oxygen. So it's in the rumen of the animal, and also it's in, if you have just giant piles of manure that don't get turned, there's not going to be any air in there either.
And those huge ponds where they collect all the cattle waste.
Yeah, but there are some really interesting things going on. There's some dairy farms even here in New York State that they actually capture that waste, they bring it into a contained area, and they're doing it, and they have an anaerobic digester that generates actually methane for fuel purposes. So they're actually running their farm on the animal waste. So that's what we need more of, these closed systems where we tie all this together.
Evie, we got to take a break here, but thank you very much. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Daryl Mosier is our guest, and we hit the home stretch. Still about 20 minutes to go. Hang in there.
Support for WAMC comes from Cafe Capriccio. Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com. Bard's Fisher Center, presenting Summerscape 2015. Highlights to include Ethel Smith's opera The Wreckers, July 24th through August 2nd. Tickets now available, fishercenter.bard.edu. And the UMass Fine Arts Center, presenting A Sea of Puppets, Taiwanese glove puppets, on Sunday with a post-show meet and greet in Boker Auditorium, fineartscenter.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Yeah, it's Friday. That means it's a Food Friday. Daryl Mosier's here from the Culinary Institute. We've had an interesting discussion with you about sustainable agriculture and food policy. And Daryl, here's one from email. This is from Bruce. Oh, no, it's from Facebook, actually. What is your opinion on pesticides and related chemicals? My key concern around GMOs is that many are apparently designed to allow for heavier applications of pesticides and related chemicals. And from a scientific perspective, it seems like it's pretty much impossible to truly prove that decades of consuming very small quantities of pesticide residue is not detrimental to our health. For example, how do you isolate the impact of some particular pesticide consumed in tiny quantities over, say, 75 years? So it seems to me, saith Bruce, to be wise to reduce our consumption of such chemicals, and GMOs are pushing things in the opposite direction. That is from Bruce on Facebook.
All right, Bruce. One of the there's a distinct difference, certainly, between GMOs and pesticides. Pesticide, simple definition by the FDA, is anything placed on a plant to alter its growth. And a big misconception is that organic growers do not use pesticides. They absolutely do. They use naturally occurring ones, whereas your conventional growers will use synthetics. Many of the early GMOs, it's interesting, were actually designed to use less pesticide. For example, the BT corn. They put a gene from a fungus, Bacillus thuringiensis, into the corn so that if an earworm would eat the corn, it would die, and it preempted a spray program. So there was a cost advantage to the farmer, and that, besides just cost, less trips on the field, so soil issues, compaction, and things like that. So some of the early GMO work was, in fact, aimed at reducing pesticide use.
All right, let's go over to Jim in Malta. Jim, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This question is probably something my daughter could get answered by an advisor in school, but this is fortuitous because I'll have something to talk to her about when she comes home from school in a few weeks.
Fair enough.
She's majoring in environmental studies with a specialty dealing with food sustainability, and she's a senior at SUNY Plattsburgh, and she'll be graduating in the next year. And I was never really clear with her about what kind of job opportunities are there for someone like her when she graduates. Or is it the field where you really have to go on for your master's degree?
No, I think there's certainly jobs at the bachelor's level. maybe better jobs, more impact would require additional school. Within communities, there's, you know, there's a lot of food programs, somebody involved in that, a lot of our NGOs, or even our supermarket chains. They have sustainability commitments now, and they're hiring people that basically administer and run those programs. So it's pretty wide open. I would not be discouraged in terms of opportunity. If that's where her passion is, she just needs to get out there and start this ball rolling and make a little difference.
It all began in high school when she went from vegetarian to vegan. And now she volunteers at various farms around Plattsburgh. So, but it just seemed like there might be a hard road to find a job. But as long as there's possibility out there, I feel a little more.
No, there's absolutely
optimistic.
Yeah, and more urban settings. There's a lot of activity in this area, along with the social issues associated with food, things like food security, food sovereignty. She shouldn't be deterred. Good luck to her.
All right, thanks, Jim.
Yeah, you said you got your master's at in Vermont.
Yeah, there's I actually have another class to go. It's been hard finding time, but it's Green Mountain College. They have a wonderful director, a guy named Philip Ackerman Least. He's actually written a book called Rebuilding the Food Shed that's probably worth reading, and it's a good program, very comprehensive.
Oh, right, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thanks, Jim. We appreciate it. Let's go over to Peggy in Queman's Hollow. Hiya, Peggy, you're up.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering why it seems so hard to get local grown lamb. Every time I go to a supermarket, all I see is lamb imported from Australia, and that can't be a very good environmental footprint.
Well, I mean, you'd be surprised. Even the average food we eat that we go to our supermarket has traveled 2,000 miles. I mean, the reason is a term called comparative advantage. They can grow the lamb a lot cheaper, and it's just a really good environment for growing lamb. If you're interested in local sourcing lamb, though, there are lots of small producers in the area, and they would be glad to have you come to their farm and buy their lamb that they've had butchered by USDA and cut and wrapped and ready to go right from the farm.
Okay, good. As I said, every time I go to a supermarket, it's always Australia.
Yeah, they've got a lot of open land. They've got great pasture for the grazing for the animals. They've got the system down, and it just economically it just works better than big scale here in this country.
Okay, thank you for answering my question.
Sure.
Thanks, Peggy. We appreciate the call. Let's go over to Barbara in Albany. Hiya, Barbara, you're up.
Hi. I just wanted to discuss GMOs just very briefly. There are some sites on the internet that show the scientific research on GMOs, both positive and negative, and one of them is gmo-awareness.com, which is really a very good one that has scientific studies, and I think people should go on that site and try to decide for themselves.
Barbara, I'll just jump in. There's lots of information on the internet, and there's various levels of information, peer-reviewed information versus just general information.
Well, this is peer-reviewed, and it's like Scientific American recommends it and things like that. So yeah. Also, responsibletechnology.org is an excellent.
Yeah, and like I said, GMOs, there's no panacea, and especially, you know, things like biodiversity, open source seed, clearly it'd be better if we didn't have to use them, but where we are, I think we do.
Thanks, Barbara. We appreciate the call. Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Barb in Mountain Dale, New York. How are things in Mountain Dale, Barb?
Oh, it's sunny and gorgeous here.
Well, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I have a question about seafood. Wild-caught versus farm-raised?
Yep.
My husband is not a fish eater, and he was pretty gleeful telling me something he heard about wild-caught seafood eating a lot of ocean garbage and bits of plastic.
No, I mean, wild-caught seafood, in terms of food safety, is certainly safe. It's healthy. It may not be sustainable. There is our ocean's waters, and especially with some of our major species.
Like cod, right?
Yeah, cod. Cod's been significantly depleted. I mean, our fishery, I think last year, 50,000 tons of cod out of the Grand Banks, and until before 1980, the number was closer to 800,000 tons for a 50-year period. So, I mean, that's a significant decline in that fishery. Farm-raised, that's the area that's growing. I mean, that's one area of our food system where we're seeing a lot of growth. There are some good things in farm-raised, there's some bad things. One thing I don't like about a lot of the things we farm-raise are fish that we need to feed them fish to get them to grow fast and have good feed conversion ratios. I don't think it makes sense to grind up sardines to grow a shrimp or a potentially another fish when you're actually could have eaten the sardines and gotten twice the amount of nutrition out of them. So it's there's a lot to know, but there's a lot of good organizations. The Monterey Bay Sea Watch group has a lot of information on seafood.
Now, what you're just saying about grinding up the fish, could that eventually turn into any kind of fishy mad cow fish, mad fish disease, something like that?
I wouldn't worry about that. That's the prion in the brain of certain mammals. No, I mean, the fish in the wild eat fish. I mean, that's the point. They, like salmon, for example, very relatively short digestive tract. They can't eat. You can't feed them corn, soybean, and get good growth. They have to eat high protein inputs.
All right. Barb, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Daryl Mosier of CIA is our guest. Here are a couple. One came from email. This one's from Facebook. This is from Lisa. All right, get ready now. I believe your guest is mistaken about pollen drift GMO lawsuits not occurring in the U.S. Settlements will gag litigants. I do not believe it is urban or rural legend that Monsanto et al. Have gone after U.S. farmers for drift.
Sorry to disappoint you. Okay. I would be very interested if you could find any definitive information contrary. I've spent a lot of time looking and talked to a great number of people. I believe it is in fact an urban legend.
All right, and let's go to an email from our friend Julius. The FDA has approved neonicotinoids as a safe pesticide, yet significant evidence exists to link those pesticides to a dangerous decline in honeybee populations. Comments, please. That's from Jules.
Yeah, the neonicotinoids, it works with a nerve action in insects, and there is, I don't know if it's good evidence, but they're because of the colony collapse in honeybees and how important they are to our pollination of our fruits and vegetables, there's a definite concern. I mean, I don't believe it's been proven scientifically, and I'm not saying that I'm a big supporter of those or even the organophosphates that we can use conventionally that also have a high impact on honeybees if they're applied at the wrong time. I mean, that's the nature of pesticides. The one good thing I can say, if you want to review it as good, is that today's pesticides are scrutinized very carefully, and significantly they're designed to have relatively short half-lives. They break down fairly quickly after they've been sprayed. The real risk is not with the consumer, it's with the applicator. The farm person is at great risk when he works with these things.
All right, let's go back to our phone calls. Daryl Mosier is our guest. Let's go to Larry in Columbia County. Hiya, Larry, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, Dell. My question to you is, when you cook beef, where do you purchase your beef from?
Kosicki Farms in Rhinebeck, New York.
What's the name of it?
Kosicki Farms. Yeah.
Right.
It's in Rhinebeck, New York. I will buy beef at a local Hannaford, for example.
You're not necessarily grass-fed, organic, local, grass-finished, necessarily.
No, I'm big on local. So if it's a local person and I have access to it, I'm going to buy local. Grass-fed, I mean, I like the vision. The sustainability issues are very complicated. It isn't clear that grass-fed is more sustainable than, unfortunately, our production and the confined animal feed operations, but it sure looks a lot nicer, and I think it's better for the animal, which is a whole nother element of the animal welfare.
Larry, thank you very much. Over to Lee in Statsburg. Lee, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Ray, and thank you, Mr. Mosier. This is a great show. Really happy to bring light to this very important subject. So thank you.
Thank you.
And in addition to the local war movement and really bringing our awareness and our money locally to our farms and farmers, there's something that I recently came upon, a book called The Wild Wisdom of Weeds, The 13 Essential Plants for Human Survival by Katrina Blair. And in this wonderful book, she talks about these 13 wild weeds, including chickweed and mallow and dandelion, and she has they're grown just about everywhere on Earth, and she has edible preparations and medicinal preparations, and in terms of self-responsibility and true food security, I think we need to be taking more and more responsibility as well.
No question. Foraging has a history, and it's still there are lots of people. There are a lot of natural plants that are that are edible and certainly nutritious.
And it's a great art. We did a program on foraging, and it was immensely popular. And the lady brought various things that I only thought grew on the side of roads, and it was delicious. So it opened my eyes, I'll tell you that. But I would not want to pick things from the ground that I didn't know what they were and eat them.
Yeah, in particular, size of highways. You know, a lot of years ago when there was lead in the gas, there can get into root systems, depending if you're eating the root of the plant. It's
Still, you forage the wrong mushroom, and it's bye-bye.
It absolutely is.
So you need to do some homework before you do that stuff. Let's go to Susan in Red Hook. Susan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I like to bake, and so I heard something about using flowers in the U.S., U.S. flowers are not healthy because of the way they harvest and process it, and they have it much more, they've got it right over in Europe. Do you have any information about that?
No, I'm not really a baking and pastry person. What I know about flowers, the fresh flower is important. A flower actually doesn't have a very good shelf life. I really can't help you with that. I don't know. European. Okay. I would think there's artisanal flowers here in this country that would rival the European ones.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks. And, Susan, we've done actually shows with bread bakers, and they have discussed just this issue, and they're very particular about the flowers that they use, and I'm sure we'll do that again. So be listening on a Food Friday coming up.
Okay, I'll look in the archives, too.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Let's go over to Jeff and Gardner. Jeff, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. My call was the same as Susan's, really. It's I've heard that when they harvest the wheat, what they do is they poison it with an herbicide exactly one week before they're going to harvest it, because the natural reaction for the dying plant is to what they call bolt to seed, where actually we're harvesting the seed of the wheat, and so that actually adds to the harvest a little bit. But
yeah, it's possible that practice
has been poisoned.
Well, it's clearly poisoned from a plant basis. The question is, what is
that
poison?
Yes, I know I'm not an herbicide. I know I'm not an herb.
Yeah.
But
if you don't like it, I think there are options. I mean, they do the same thing with potatoes. Before they harvest potatoes, they basically go through and they do vine kill. They put an herbicide, drives the vines down, so they're much easier to harvest. You don't have all that plant material.
I think potato is the worst case, because a tuber is going to store a lot of stuff in the tuber. The plant is going to store stuff into the tuber.
Well, that's true. That's a roll of tuber. It stores the starch.
So I think organic potatoes might be a good idea. But thank you very much for
the
chance
to
mouth off.
That's what we do on this program. Mike in Middletown. Mike, you're up.
Hi. I actually had a question and a comment.
Okay.
Quickly, in reference to the question, what I wanted to find out is that it seems as though when you go out to places to eat, you get really nice cuts of beef or so on. Everything is just so buttery. Everything seems to be so great. Are they using high quality product, or where can I get this product from? And what do I need to do to prepare it in order to make it seem
good,
like restaurants?
Let me tell you, good restaurants definitely use the best quality ingredients. I mean, we teach our students that. It's all about the ingredient. You can't be a great chef if you don't have a great ingredient. So,
right.
But a lot of our markets, butcher shops, sell a pretty good ingredient. You want to buy a better ingredient, a prime cut. The big difference in a steakhouse is their grills are really hot. They're 1,200, 1,500 degrees even sometimes, and you can't do that in your home.
Okay.
Okay. And my comment was in reference to the whole thing with the wheat.
Yes.
Was basically, I've done a lot of research, and I find that years ago we used to process wheat completely different. We used to knock it down and leave it out there for a day or so, if not a few days, and allow it to sprout. And what it would do is it would create certain enzymes that were actually healthy for us in order to process the product.
Oh, fascinating.
But nowadays, it seems as though what we do is we knock it down and we take it right away. We don't give it time to sprout. There are actually products out there that are sprouted wheat products, sprouted wheat breads, that are probably about $4.99 for a loaf of bread, sprouted wheat bread. But I'm finding that those products, if people have certain allergies to wheats and things like that, they're so much easier digestible because they give you the enzymes.
Okay. Mike, we're out of time, buddy.
Years ago.
I appreciate the call, though. Thanks very much. And thank you to Daryl Mosier. Great job. I hope you come back again soon.
I'd be glad to. I think it's an important discussion. I appreciate this forum and this opportunity.
And we'll be looking for that new major at Culinary Institute of America. Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Audio Video Corporation, offering design and integration services for the boardroom, the conference room, and the classroom since 1946. AudioVideoCorp.com. And Vision XL Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or VisionXLEyeCare.com. Thanks again for listening and for calling. Thanks to Daryl Mosier. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by the inimitable Colleen O'Connell. Thanks to our producer, Jessica Blaustein. Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday. Alan will be in the chair for a medical Monday. Stay tuned now for a news update.